You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, do you dread going back to work after the weekend or after some time off? A psychologist gives us some advice on dealing with what some people call the Sunday scaries. Now, things are winding down for the state legislature, and that means Governor Evers has been busy either approving or vetoing bills. Legislation on criminal justice and tax cuts are just some of the items that the governor recently took action on. And WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White is with us to break down some of the top stories. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Let's start with the veto of some criminal justice legislation. Remind us what the legislature had passed here.
So the legislature passed six bills in this criminal justice package, and Governor Evers vetoed four of them on Friday. Generally, what they would do is increase criminal penalties in Wisconsin. Republicans who sponsored these bills said they were in response to crime numbers in Wisconsin. They were a way to kind of crack down on crime in the state. Democrats were really pushing back and saying this isn't the way to combat crime. We shouldn't be locking more people up. We need to spend more money in programs for people after they're released. And they also pointed out that Wisconsin's prison systems are currently over capacity at about 130% of capacity. So when the governor vetoed these bills last week, it was really kind of an extension of that Democratic argument against the proposals that we'd seen all along.
And then what's the reaction from Republicans in the legislature who passed these bills?
So Republicans are perhaps not surprisingly pretty upset about this. Speaker Voss, Assembly Speaker Voss from the Assembly, actually issued a pretty fiery statement. He said, Governor Evers, this is a direct quote, Governor Evers refuses to hold criminals accountable to please his liberal let-them-out-of-jail backers. His actions today clearly show how far left he is compared to the general public. So Speaker Voss, they're definitely coming out with some strong words for the governor, showing how displeased he was with the veto.
And likely to be an election message from Republicans?
I think so. You know, this was a pretty high-profile thing that Republicans rallied behind this session, saying that they were responding to concerns that had been brought forward by their constituents, doing exactly what they should be doing in the Capitol, kind of working to alleviate problems that people had brought to them, and that Governor Evers isn't being responsive to that.
And another big veto now, the proposed tax cuts passed by the legislature in part because of a state budget surplus. What happened there?
Well, you know, you talk about something that's going to be used potentially on the campaign trail. I think this is a biggie, if not the biggie. So Republicans passed this income tax cut, property tax cut for businesses, and a little bit of a debt payment in response to larger than expected tax collections that Wisconsin was able to take in recently. Governor Evers raised some concerns with the Republican plan from the very beginning. He had his own plan. He wanted to spend money on education and do a little bit of property tax relief kind of linked in with his education plan. So we weren't entirely sure whether this veto was going to happen, even though the governor had been critical. He did go ahead and veto it, though, and issued the veto last week, a week ago today, actually, in a school, kind of driving home that message that he wanted more money to go to schools instead, and said, you know, I want Republicans in the legislature to come back. I want them to negotiate with this on me. I think negotiate about this with me and figure out a way that we can get some money to schools and send some money to tax relief. We don't have to choose one or the other. We can do both.
Talking to Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, about action by the governor vetoing some big pieces of legislation. And Laurel, let's get to things that he signed into law that came from lawmakers. Let's start with the HOPE agenda on opioids. This is a multi-year process, a lot of bills sponsored by Republican John Nygren, among others, dealing with the opioid epidemic in the state. What kind of things went from the legislature and got signed by the governor?
So there were four new bills signed by the governor yesterday in the HOPE agenda. That takes the total HOPE agenda to, according to Representative Nygren, to 34 bills. So a pretty large package of legislation there that's made its way through the Capitol. These new proposals do a variety of things. They expand access to housing. One bill would mandate that state employees couldn't be penalized for undergoing medication-assisted treatment for their addiction. which is something that Representative Nygren really advocated for. Another thing would expand Badger Care to peer recovery coaches in Wisconsin, individuals that come in and help support people struggling with addiction as they're going through the treatment and recovery process. Representative Nygren talked about how helpful those peer coaches can be for individuals struggling with addiction. So now they're going to have another way to fund that kind of treatment.
Another item that really comes up year after year in the legislature is drunk driving and the punishment and sentences for different drunk driving charges. What changes did we see come out here?
So we've got two new laws under that umbrella. One of them increases the minimum sentence for a fifth or sixth OWI offense from 6 months to 18 months. There is a little bit of judicial discretion written in there, so a judge doesn't necessarily have to go all the way up to 18 months if he or she doesn't want to. But it is in law now that the minimum is no longer 6 but 18 months. Another proposal that made its way all the way to the governor and got his signature is a technical fix to actually a bill that Governor Walker signed, so a law that was passed in 2017, that's the so-called four strikes and you're out policy, which revokes someone's license if they're convicted of a fourth or subsequent OWI offense. There had just been some issues with enforcing that, some confusion about how far to look back for previous offenses, how long there could be between different offenses. So the change that passed out of the legislature and the governor signed just allows, in the governor's words, allows the law to be implemented as it was meant to be to begin with.
Another kind of technical change here has to do with body cam footage for police departments. Not every department has these body cameras, and this law won't change that. But what does change?
So this is a really interesting one because it was very controversial in the Capitol. There was a lot of conflict between law enforcement and open records advocates. They actually got together, worked together on a bill, came up with a consensus, and passed this out of the legislative, out of both chambers and got the signature from the governor. So a real feel-good story of state government here. What this does is it creates standards for law enforcement, says they have to have written policies for how body cameras are used, things like who in the department wears a body camera, how they determine that. There's a new standard for how long body camera data needs to be retained. There's a minimum of 120 days under this law. And it also talks about how open body camera footage should be, who should be able to access it, when it should be made private, and essentially sets a standard that the data should be available to inspection and to copying unless there are a few things at play, like if there's a sensitive or a violent crime, if the subject is in a location where they have a reasonable expectation of privacy, or if minors are involved. So really sets out some rules for how body cameras are used in Wisconsin, and it's been something that lawmakers have been working on for a long time.
Before we move on to some bigger picture stuff, Laurel, anything else stood out to you that got signed or not yesterday?
Well, a couple interesting bills that we've been talking about in the Capitol. There was one actually the governor signed yesterday making bestiality a felony in Wisconsin. I know that's made some headlines across the state. Folks may have heard about that one a little bit. It's now officially law. The governor also vetoed a bill that had been getting some attention, which would have legalized paddle wheel raffles in Wisconsin. Some folks might be familiar with those. They're sometimes used for fundraisers, things like that. The governor vetoed that because he thought that it would potentially infringe on native rights and gambling in Wisconsin. He said that the expansion could threaten the exclusive rights of tribal nations to conduct a specific type of gaming in Wisconsin, Class 3 gaming. So kind of an interesting debate there.
And as we wrap up, Laurel, anything else still on the table where we're waiting to see what the governor's going to do?
We are. You know, I think it's going to be really interesting to see particularly what the state Senate has to do when they come back later this month and what they're going to send the governor in that last batch of bills and what he chooses to sign from what they send him. Some of the big profile, I think arguably one of the biggest things is that package of legislation to help Wisconsin dairy farmers. The Senate still has to vote on that, and then we'll see what the governor does with it.
Laurel, thanks a lot for being with us.
Absolutely, anytime.
That's Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter. She was with us today to round up some of the recent bill approvals and vetoes out of the governor's office. Coming up, according to new data, radium levels in Wisconsin's groundwater have gone up over the past two decades. We'll look at the numbers and how it's affecting local governments around the state. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, radium levels in Wisconsin groundwater have gotten higher over the last two decades. A WPR reporter will break down the numbers for us and look at how local governments are responding. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum asking the question, what was Milwaukee's first hip-hop song?
Our friends at 88.9 Radio Milwaukee put out a podcast last year called Backspin, the search for Milwaukee's first hip-hop song.
Are you ready?
Hosts Tyrone Miller.
I'm just really curious about just hip-hop in general. Love the culture, been a part of it my whole life.
And Justin Barney.
My interest in this is academic. I want to know what the first hip-hop song is. That I want to answer that question.
They take listeners on a musical and historical journey as they talk with pioneering Milwaukee DJs and reminisce about dance clubs and house parties of the past. While listening to Backspin, you quickly learn that what is Milwaukee's first hip-hop song is a really complicated question. Milwaukee's first hip-hop record could be this song, Class A. It was released in 1981 by The Majestics.
We are down, and for real, we all have a lot of sex appeal. So hey, by the way, the women say we are Class A.
The Majestics were a funk and R&B group that put out a disco rap song.
Do y'all consider yourselves rappers, or did y'all just make a rap song?
We just made a rap song.
That's right.
We ain't no five, we rappers. When dream of it. Because you don't call anybody can rap.
Yeah.
Because you rapping now, just put the music behind you.
Right.
See?
After Class A came out, it didn't have a huge impact. It didn't inspire a new wave of rappers. But then this song came along in 1985.
Music is formatic, it's implied without static. But I'm not only deed, if that's emphatic. My rhymes give a sound that not kind or benign, but appropriate in battle. Whenever it's time, you know.
We were definitely the first, like, official hip-hop crew to release a record of hip-hop in Milwaukee. And that was the song called Attack on the Wax.
That's Todd Thomas, a.k.a. Peachy, a.k.a. Speech.
Excuse me, Peachy. May I?
May you what?
May I get on the turntables?
Why, of course.
And we felt it was cool, but we felt, at least me, I felt we could do better. So we went back in the studio and did a better version of that song and included three other songs on that EP, I should say.
PG on the steel, and you know he's chill. Two techniques under his hand, cause that's the real deal. Fresh beats are delivered to the north, then south, and at
any given jam, he keeps fucking the house.
Yeah, that was the first hip-hop record that I remember, though, from a hip-hop crew.
Miller and Barney found the majority of the music community credits Speech with jumpstarting the city's hip-hop scene.
Every single person that we've talked to, from the MCs, the DJs, producers, every single person mentioned Speech. Is that correct?
Literally every single one.
And it was not just, okay, I rapped with him. He produced a song for him. He influenced them by just being such a great guy in the community. Or they knew him, they worked with him, they met with him. They just knew where he lived. He was just around.
And everyone had such reverence,
right,
for Speech.
One of the things that I think people wouldn't realize is that we never traveled to New York. We didn't know anybody that ever written or did a rap record. So for us, it was a lot of guessing. And unlike today, there was no internet. You couldn't go to YouTube and check out how somebody did something. And we were trying to do the best we could to make an authentic hip-hop record. You know, like, I didn't want to be just a quote-unquote Milwaukee artist. You know what I mean? Like, I knew that Milwaukee had to rise to the occasion of New York because New York was defining hip-hop. And, you know, I wanted Milwaukee to have that same legitimate sound. And I feel like we accomplished it with that EP.
Soon after, Speech left Milwaukee to go to school in Atlanta, where he formed the Grammy Award-winning group Arrested Development. The rest is music history. Check out Radio Milwaukee's podcast Backspin and decide for yourself. was the city's first hip-hop song Class A, or Attack on the Wax? Does it even matter what came first? Take a deeper dive into this story through the podcast Backspin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, a new analysis of DNR data by researchers at UW-Madison finds that the level of radium in Wisconsin's groundwater went up between 2000 and 2018. That's causing local governments to devote more attention and money to treating their water to meet federal safety standards. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. She joins us from our studio there. Danny, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Can you start us off with a quick Radium 101? What is it and why do we worry about it?
Yeah. So radium is a naturally occurring radioactive metal, and it can be concerning because it can cause harmful health effects if you're exposed at high levels over long periods of time. Some of the harmful health effects that it could cause would include anemia, cataracts, or bone cancer.
And this, a lot of times when we talk about water pollution, it's stuff that humans emitted. As you said, this is naturally occurring, and then it ends up in the water that we're pulling up out of the ground, right?
Yeah. It can be found in rock, soil, or water, or other elements. But basically, it's becoming a problem here in Wisconsin because it's found naturally in rocks and because of the geology of our state. And so researchers looked at this aquifer underlying basically the southern two-thirds of the state. And basically, it's unique geologically where they have this thick shale layer that separates or limits interaction between the surface water and the groundwater below. And so that groundwater really has an opportunity to sit there for a long time and more of a chance to interact with all the rocks that are down there. And so there's more opportunity for things to dissolve, and it's more prone to having higher levels of radium.
Now, before people panic, because we're finding this radium in the groundwater, it doesn't necessarily mean it's in the tap when you turn it on.
No, because what they sampled, the researchers sampled, was water from public water supply wells. And what's in these wells is not necessarily what makes it to the tap, because anytime the levels approach that standard that could be concerning, which is 5 picocuries per liter, they have to treat for that to remove radium. So what's in those wells is not necessarily what's making it to tap water.
But what happens as those levels go up in the groundwater, does that mean it's more difficult and or expensive for that local treatment facility to get that radium out before it gets to us?
Yeah, so that's kind of what they're looking at here, because what they saw is that these levels went up in the eastern part of the state, kind of in that radium belt along the Lake Michigan shoreline, from 5.5 to 7.9 picocuries per liter. And a picocurie is a really small amount of radioactivity. It's basically like a trillionth of a gram of radium. But that's how they measure it in water. And the EPA has set a standard that you shouldn't have more than 5 picocuries per liter of radium in your water. And so basically they're saying that communities could see more of a potential to have to treat for this if the radium levels keep going up. So it's kind of a heads up for water utilities that this is something that might need to watch for. And, you know, this could be a bigger problem for smaller communities that have fewer resources than bigger cities to treat for this.
And then the mystery here, I guess, is why radium levels are going up in groundwater. What are some of the ideas that researchers are talking about?
Yeah, so a couple of factors that they think are playing a role in this are just the wet conditions that we've had in the last decade or so. Basically, they think that there's been less groundwater pumping because we've seen a lot of rising of the water table. Another factor is that as we've seen other types of concerns related to contaminants like nitrates from fertilizer or, you know, emerging contaminants like PFAS, communities are looking to drill their municipal wells deeper. And as they're looking to escape one type of contaminant, unfortunately, they're encountering another.
Now, this is new news for a lot of the state. One place where radium is an old news story and ongoing is Waukesha. They're working on tapping into a whole new source of water to avoid radium, right?
Right, yeah. They initially started looking into their high radium levels a long time ago. And so what they found was that there was a decline in their drinking water source there, a decline in the aquifer, and that's exacerbating those high levels of radium. So they sought permission from the Great Lakes governors to be able to divert 8.2 million gallons of water from Lake Michigan to replace their drinking water source. And now they're moving forward with a project to build a $286 million water diversion, which involves the construction of pipelines that draw water from the city of Milwaukee and return it after treatment to the Root River, which flows into Lake Michigan. And that's all in an effort to address their radium levels there.
Right. So, Danny, as we wrap up, we've got this research showing higher levels of radium in our groundwater. Again, not in our tap water yet. But what's next in this story, either for research or for what local governments are going to do about this?
Well, I think the next thing that they would like to take more of a look at is exactly what played a role in the increase. You know, was it those wet conditions and was it the, you know, well construction practices that really caused these the increase in the levels? You know, what is it that's prompting the increase, and will that be something to look for in the future?
Danielle, we'll keep watching for that. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rob.
Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. She talked to us about data showing radium levels in Wisconsin's groundwater have gone up over the last 20 years, especially in the eastern part of the state. Coming up, do you ever feel a little anxious on your Sunday evenings before you go back to work for the week? Surveys say the average arrival time for the Sunday blues is 3:58 p.m. for some reason. We'll talk about why some of us get these feelings and if there are ways around it. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on the morning show, check out a big season for the Milwaukee Bucks. Not this year, but 1971, when the Bucks went all the way with a couple of the most legendary players in NBA history. Find out more with the author of the new book, From Coin Toss to Championship. That's tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Now, maybe you've experienced this before. It's Sunday afternoon or whatever your last day off is in your work week. You're starting to feel kind of anxious, maybe some feelings of regret or feeling like you didn't get done what you were supposed to. Just feeling all around a little down, maybe even some dread at going back to work. There are a lot of names people use to refer to this feeling, maybe the Sunday evening feeling, the Sunday blues, more recently the Sunday scaries. A 2018 survey by LinkedIn found that 80% of working American adults worry about the upcoming work week on Sundays. Is there something we can do about it? Regan Gruing is the executive director of the Center for Teaching and Learning at Oregon State University and professor of psychological sciences. Regan, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
Have you ever been here? Regan, I have. Not really with my job now, but I have had that in the past, that like, oh no, back to work tomorrow feeling.
Absolutely. I think there are definitely times when you hit that point and you start thinking about the next week. And the moment you start thinking about the next week, you're increasing your cognitive load. And all of a sudden, that calmness that you had seems to dissipate. So, yep, that happens. But I think, you know, there are some good ways around that. And what I'm really amused by is there was this study that actually even tried to pinpoint when that feeling begins. 3:58 p.m. on Sunday, apparently.
Set your alarm for that, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Avoid that time. So, yeah, absolutely. Been there and probably putting things into place to not get there too often.
Now, it seems like there can be a lot of different reasons to feel this, and maybe there's different approaches. I don't know. One is if you have a job you don't like, a job that makes you unhappy. Ideally, the perfect solution is to get a new job, but reality doesn't always allow that. Do you have thoughts for a person in that situation, Regan? They're going back to that job they don't like, and they gotta. Are there ways to sort of not let that spoil the end of the weekend?
I think there are a couple of things going on here, Rob, and I think you started on the right path, which is, you know, you got to figure out the why is it happening, and then think about the what. And, you know, let's just take a look at both of those real quickly. I mean, if you look at the why, and if it is job-related, very often some things to try and look at are what elements of the job don't you like? Is it how much control you have? Can you do something that'll give you more control? Are you bored? Are you feeling under-recognized for your efforts? I think the more we try and parse out what is it about that job or about our weekday schedules that we don't like, I think we can take a step towards doing something about it. So if we can identify it, you know, and for many of us, or for many individuals who do have job stress or who don't like their jobs, identifying it is actually not that hard. And then the question becomes, what are you going to do about it? And you can take either an approach sort of strategy, let's see if we can tackle it, what is within my control, or you can take an avoidance strategy. And in the short run, avoidance is okay. It keeps those emotions at bay. But in the long run, that's not the best coping mechanism to go with. So I think it starts with saying, what is it specifically that I'm not looking forward to? And what do I have control over and what do I not have control over? And if that not have control over list is longer, you want to then try finding ways to find pleasure in what you're doing. And very often it's in how you appraise the situation.
And is it going to help us even if, okay, there's big problems we have with our work, but even if we take some baby steps that tackle at least some subset of our problems, is that going to make a significant difference, do you think?
Absolutely. And I think along those lines, sometimes it's really as the first step is not even the baby steps, but it's seeing if you can change how you view those elements of the job. I think for many individuals, their jobs are stressful. And when you take a look at the psychology of stress, whenever we consider something a stressor, it's a stressor because we view it and we consider it either a threat or a harm. But there are three types of appraisals, and threat and harm are just two. The third type is challenge. Sometimes changing our appraisal from something being threatening or harmful to something being challenging can make enough of a change in how you view it to help you feel better about it.
Talking to psychology professor Regan Goering from Oregon State University, looking at that feeling you might get when it's the last day of the weekend or whatever your weekend might be. You got to go back to work or maybe school, and there's some dread. It kind of spoils the rest of your time off. You can join in, by the way, if you've experienced this or overcome it at 800-642-1234. Regan, in reading reporting on this, though, you know, we talked about the people who don't like their jobs. A lot of people say, I love my job. And yet, that the end of the weekend, I start to think about it and that it can still feel like it's spoiling the weekend. How do we start to diagnose what's going on in that situation?
Right. So I think there's one of the big problems with how many of us structure our lives today is that we allocate self-time to the weekends only. You know, we go, oh, it's Saturday or Sunday. Now I can sleep in. Now I can treat myself. Now I can do this. Now I can do that. As we get to the end of the weekend, part of what's going on, even if we love our jobs, is basically we're saying to ourselves, oh, five more days of no self-time, right? And I think part of the reason we feel those feelings on Sundays is because we don't give ourselves enough self-time on weekdays. And I think that's something we, each of us, can explicitly do something about. And I'll give you a simple example. Every Sunday here in Oregon, we go for a walk out in the woods amongst the trees. And it's one of the neatest things. We do it as a family. We try out one of the multiple neat trails around Corvallis. And it's gorgeous. And something I realized is, why just keep it to the Sundays? Carve up some time where you can take a shorter walk during the week. So it's not just, oh, I got to wait for the weekend for that nice time, and now Monday is coming, and I'm back to being at work all the time. You know, I think there are these little changes that we can make in how we plan our lives out, so it's not this black and white weekend versus the weekdays.
Our producer Natalie came across an interesting piece focusing on the Saturday side of things, the first day off. A writer called Jayan Yankovic on a website called Man Repeller. She says she's overwhelmed, this author, on Saturday because, you know, you're overwhelmed that you're not going to make your weekend count, all that stuff. And then probably on Sunday night, that leads to a feeling of regret. So how do we overcome that urge to start the weekend off by thinking we're going to do all the stuff we want
right.
to do?
Right. Yeah, to sort of keep that so-called Saturday spiral in check, I think, you know, this comes back to a classic good plan for keeping stress at bay in your life in general. Plan well. You know, plan well, and actually plan for time doing nothing. Plan for time, you know, for random things going on. I think far too often we go into the weekend thinking, it's the weekend, you know, I don't want to plan things, because we are so used to just planning to get work done. But I think the more we start planning fun things, and also literally planning, and this sounds paradoxical, but plan to do nothing. So if you've planned to do nothing, doing nothing doesn't feel like you haven't accomplished anything. You've actually accomplished your plan. And I think that's one of those things that can keep that Saturday spiral that author talked about at bay.
Regan, let me throw another scenario at you that I think a lot of people have experienced, a weekend or maybe even it keeps you up at night. Again, the job's okay, but you've got a big project, presentation, whatever it might be, and your mind latches onto it, even when you're off work, and you can't let it go. Maybe it's anxiety. Maybe you're just fixated on it. What are strategies that we can use to overcome that feeling?
Yeah, you know, in coping with stressors, especially stressors that are mental, like the ones you meant about, you know, that you talked about, you know, I already mentioned trying to change your appraisal of it and seeing it more as a challenge. But more practical, pragmatic strategies are sometimes sitting down and writing out what you're feeling. In the health psychology literature, there's this great intervention that was started many years ago that where the results are just wonderful, called emotional expression, where you sit yourself down and almost set a timer and tell yourself that for 15 minutes or 10 minutes, you are just going to write about your feelings and your emotions related to why you're feeling stressed and all the people around you who are there to help you. So this actual expression of emotion, putting it down on paper, or if you want, typing it out, has been shown to relate to significant decreases in stress. If it's something like a presentation, sometimes, you know, here's a great example where avoidance is actually okay. Avoidance of in the short term, not thinking about it, watching a new show just so that you're not thinking about that presentation. If it's a short-term stressor, avoidance works pretty well, but emotional expression, if you haven't tried it or folks haven't tried that, just an absolutely neat coping mechanism where you're actually facing it, getting it out there, and that's been shown to lead to some pretty good feelings afterwards.
We're talking about what some people are calling the Sunday scaries, the anxious or sad feelings you might get Sunday afternoon or night, thinking about the work week or whatever your weekend days happen to be. Our guest is Regan Gurung, professor of psychological sciences at Oregon State University. And we want to hear from you, your stories and experiences feeling this or dealing with this. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced the Sunday blues before the work week, before the school week? Does it happen all the time? Have you figured out a way to get over it and get around it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Regan Gurung. He is a professor of psychological sciences at Oregon State University. We're talking about the Sunday evening feelings, Sunday syndrome, Sunday scaries, whatever you call it. If you feel anxiety or maybe dread of the coming work week, or maybe it's regret that you didn't do all the stuff you wanted to do over the weekend, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you every weekend, or have you been there? Tell us your story and maybe what you were able to do about it. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll go to your calls now. Mark is with us in Hartford. Mark, hello.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I've been dealing with this kind of feeling, as far as I can remember, ever since I started working, and I feel like I've been able to narrow it down to a feeling that whenever I'm at work, I kind of fly through my work, and then I wind up bored, and I've done a lot of job hopping, trying to find something that keeps me engaged at work, and I haven't been able to find it yet, and I have almost like a fear of missing out when I'm at work, of all the fun, cool things that I could be doing if I didn't have to be at work. Just wondered if the guests had any input on how to fight that.
Mark, thanks for sharing that story. I'm guessing you're not alone in all of that. Regan, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think Mark puts his finger on something really important, is that far too often, many of us who are bored or aren't as challenged enough at work don't think as much of it. But the reality is, the psychological research shows that boredom at work is actually a big workplace stressor. And I think recognizing it as, you know, we don't call it a stressor. You're like, oh, it's bored. It's not, you know, nothing harmful. But boredom in itself can be a stressor that really adds up over time. So I think this is one of those cases where, you know, taking a look at your job description, is there something that you can change to give yourself more of a challenge where you are, finding, is there a way that an initiative that you take can be followed up on or you can get support on? But you've already taken that key first step of recognizing some level of boredom there. And, you know, whereas some people may say, oh, I'd love to be bored. I don't want to be, you know, that'd be different. No, boredom's a problem. That's a stressor. Try and find some ways to find some challenge. Because over time, that has an incremental negative effect on how you feel.
Mark, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Got a message from Jacob in Dodgeville who vouches for some of the advice you shared, Regan. Jacob says whether it's stress about work or other things, keeping the notebook by your bed and writing those things down really helps with sleep and getting rid of stress. So a testimonial there, Regan, to that write it down idea.
Emotional expression does something. And I think many of us aren't used to that. There's a pretty strong gender difference. Men aren't as likely to do it, and I think more of us men should. Women are much better at capitalizing on their social support networks. Men tend not to do it to the same extent. Those are the kind of things that we can do. And, you know, even going back to Mark's call, but like Jacob's using emotional expression, there are a variety, an arsenal of coping mechanisms. If one hasn't worked, try something different.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Laura joins us now in Madison. Laura, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Laura?
Well, I've had the Sunday blues ever since college, and it was all sort of came from the fact that I didn't do enough studying over the weekend, and I would start to have the dread of Sunday, and then I would hear the 60 Minutes show at 6 p.m. on Sunday night, and the tick, 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 tick.
Oh, no.
And that would just fill me with so much dread and so much guilt. Like, you didn't even open a book this weekend. And it kind of got better after I graduated. But still, when I hear that 60 Minutes intro, I think to myself, oh, my God, what did I get done this weekend?
Wow. Laura, thank you so much for sharing that. So, Regan, we can kind of, in a bad way, learn this reaction. Even if we like our work week, maybe we just get in that pattern from, in this case, school, and it can be hard to shake.
Well, you know, to add to that, I think Laura identifies the fact that so many of us are conditioned to the kinds of things that we do on Sundays. I've heard stories of, you know, many people keep certain chores for Sunday or certain laundry for Sunday. And sure enough, doing laundry then becomes associated with, oh my gosh, it's Sunday. That means we work, you know, the next day and so on and so forth. So watching for those flags that we are conditioned to, maybe we can then uncondition some of that so we don't have those long-lasting effects. And wow, you know, conditioning is a pretty strong thing, and Laura's conditioning to that TikTok ticking seems to have definitely lasted some time. So watch those things that you're always doing on Sunday, because they could get associated with those feelings about Monday.
Laura, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Regan Gurung from Oregon State University, professor of psychological sciences there. Talk about the feeling you might get at the end of your weekend before you get ready to go back to work, that sort of maybe dread of what's to come, or regret, anxiety. It can come in a lot of different forms, and what to do about it. Now, Regan, something you started to touch on a little bit earlier, our society's laid out now that it can be hard to get stuff done during the week. Is this a bigger problem than maybe individuals can deal with some, the idea of getting a little of the weekend feeling and accomplishment into the course of our work week?
Right. You know, and I think right now what you've seen happening in society is the work week has spilled into the weekend. And I guess what I'm making a call for, an impassioned plea for, is to have the weekend spill into the work week. You know, and I think if we move in that direction and balance it out a little bit more, for many of us, doing some work on the weekend is hard not to do. I mean, I'm an academic. I teach. I get student emails. I have collaboration emails. Sometimes dealing with them for a short amount of time on the weekend works better. But by the same token, I make sure I take some time to myself and my family during the weekday. So it's not a question of, oh, here comes Monday, we'll see Dad next Saturday. You know, no, it's spreading that time out and for yourself and your family out a little bit more.
Well, something I've tried to do myself, and maybe you can weigh in on this, Regan, is, you know, sometimes I do have to do work from home or wherever I happen to be, but I've learned to try to kind of put walls up, like, okay, I'm going to be intentional and I'm going to take this 5 or 10 minutes to catch up on those emails. I'm not just going to, you know, idly, I'm at my computer, I'll just open up the email in the middle of something else.
Right. And I think, you know, it goes back to something Laura just said, the last caller, about being conditioned to certain things. I think for many of us who use a lot of email, even opening up your email, you know, I do a lot of things administratively, and there are often fires to put out. And sometimes just opening up an email means there's a fire to put out. And so I think setting up time for when you will do certain things that you know may bring a lot of stress and work is better. I mean, one of the things I do is in the mornings, I don't check email, or I try not to, and really mostly don't check email until I get to work, instead of checking it real quickly and then not being able to respond to it. And that's the same thing with weekends, is really, like you do, Rob, carving out exactly when and for how long you'll do certain things that you know may be associated with some stressful activity.
I want to take our last minute and a half or so, Regan, to come back to where we started, and you said, you know, being aware, figuring out what's going on in our lives. Give us some advice for maybe this next Sunday at 3:58 p.m. How can we attune ourselves to watch for these feelings and what might be causing them?
Well, I think I'm going to actually say two things here, because we've talked about the Sunday scaries, but I think, you know, we should also consider, do we have the daily scaries? And by that I mean, there are some of us who feel stressed every day. There are studies that show that day of the week and mood, even though we may think weekends are bad, in many studies show there aren't no big differences day to day. So if we are somebody who's experiencing the scaries daily or anxiety every evening thinking about the next day, then we really need to make sure we get some more specific pragmatic ways to deal with it. To end on that very pragmatic note, I think, you know, there's really hands down, there's no real substitute for getting some physical activity, spending and increasing your time with friends and family. That is the balm that can alleviate most stressors. And if you know that there's a time when these scaries start popping up, that's exactly the time to inject a good shot of either nature, outdoor time, physical activity, or good old friends and family.
Great place to leave it. Regan, as always, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Take care, Rob.
That's Regan Gurung, Executive Director of the Center for Teaching and Learning at Oregon State University and Professor there of Psychological Sciences. He joins to talk about what some people call the Sunday scaries, the feeling some people get as their weekend is winding down and they look ahead at the school week or work week. You can still share your experiences, maybe your advice, over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the U.S. Supreme Court is taking another look at the Affordable Care Act. We'll look at the case and what the healthcare landscape could look like if it's overturned. Reach for the stars with the new season of the TV series Cosmos. We'll talk to the creator of the show, who's written a new book about the latest research into the mysteries of the universe. And all the cool kids are doing it. We'll check out the power of peer pressure, but wait, it's not always bad. Our guest says we can harness peer pressure to make positive changes in the world. All that and look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7, a number of rural Wisconsin counties are seeing declines in population. Kate and her guest look at the causes, consequences, and possible cures for the future of those communities. That's tomorrow at 7 on the morning show. Up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a website that gets more daily visits than PayPal, ESPN, or the New York Times is turning 25 this year. We talked to the author of An Internet for the People about the longevity of Craigslist. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.